Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, this is If You Love This Planet and our weekly update on the tragic accident at Fukushima. Various happenings have occurred and people are putting two and two together to work out exactly what has happened because the flow of data and information is limited from TEPCO, the company that runs the reactor, from the Japanese government, from nuclear agencies and the like. It seems that in four spent fuel pools and three reactors, there have been meltdowns. That is, seven nuclear meltdowns. There have been hydrogen explosions at reactors 1, 2, and 3, and at the fuel pool at reactor number 4. However, what's become apparent in recent days is that there was a massive explosion at reactor 3. Now, it was different from the hydrogen explosions at reactors 1, 2, and spent fuel pool 4. It was an excursion, which means a nuclear reaction. And if you go to fairwinds.com and watch nuclear engineer Arne Gundersen explain this nuclear explosion and watch the video, you will see a violent white flash before a huge cloud of black smoke is elevated vertically into the atmosphere. This flash probably indicates a nuclear excursion or nuclear reaction, like a bomb. And the material that was sent vertically into the air almost certainly is aerosolized long-lived radioactive elements like americium, plutonium, uranium, and other really nasty things, such that americium, which is more toxic than plutonium-239, which is said to be the most carcinogenic substance on Earth, is now being found in fallout in New England. Plutonium is being found, I think, in America, and uranium on the West Coast. So this is terribly serious, very like Chernobyl. And what really deeply concerns me is the accident is not over. It may never be over. As the Japanese Prime Minister said, it may take 10 years to control the thing. All the water they're pouring into these reactors to cool them, and I could go into more details, but there isn't time. Go to the webpage nuclearfreeplanet.org and you will find more information. But the water, tons and tons of it, is weakening the containment vessels. And should there be another major aftershock or earthquake, then one or several of the reactors could actually just break. And then you would have a massive explosion like Chernobyl. So I'm sorry to present this new information to you. The oceans are becoming contaminated. Fish swim thousands of miles. You can't taste radiation in the fish. Ocean currents go from north to south, east and west, all over the place. The fallout in the air will remain mostly in the northern hemisphere because the two hemispheric air masses do not mix at the equator. So the northern hemisphere will get most of the atmospheric fallout, but the ocean contamination will spread around the globe. Okay, so that's this week's update. I'm really sorry to bring you this information, but we must all be informed, and information leads to a working democracy, and we must now get on our bicycles and our horses and close down all the nuclear power plants in America and indeed the world. Okay, thanks for listening. You'll have your next update next week. Today, my special guest is Miriam Pemberton, a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Miriam's role involves writing and speaking on demilitarization issues for the Institute's Foreign Policy in Focus project. She has recently published a report, Military versus Climate Security, Mapping the Shift from the Bush Years to the Obama Era, a follow-up to her other publication, The Budgets Compared, Military versus Climate Security. Miriam also leads a group that produces the annual Unified Security Budget for the United States. Formerly, she was editor, researcher, and finally director of the National Commission for Economic Conversion and Disarmament. With William Hartung of the New American Frontier, she's co-editor of the 2008 book, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, published by Paradigm. Miriam, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thanks so much.
Well, I think this interview is particularly timely. Here we are. America's in a great state of economic decline still, with huge joblessness and people losing their homes. Meanwhile, the military budget goes merrily along, never changing, only increasing. You could make a nursery rhyme out of that. We've got to get into this. It just makes me feel nauseated every time I look at it and think about it. Now, although you say that they're only spending $553 billion on the military in 2012, that's not right, really, is it? Because when you include the wars and you include the black areas which they fund, you know, the National Security Agency and all the rest and the secret stuff that goes on, it's nearly $1 trillion, isn't it, Miriam?
It is. And if you, I mean, that number includes the cost of caring for our veterans, and it includes, you know, the interest on the debt that we're paying now for, you know, previous military adventures. But if you put all that together, it does exceed $1 trillion a year.
And I used to say to my audiences, if you spent $1 million a minute since Jesus was born, I think you'd just get to $1 trillion now. Now, I don't know if the maths is okay or not, but I think it's fairly okay. It's obscene, isn't it?
It certainly is.
All right, and go on.
Oh, just comparing to what the rest of the world spends as well. We are spending not quite more than the rest of the world put together, but if you include our NATO allies, then we are.
The rest of the world put together. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. It's a death industry. It's a death culture. It really is. And, you know, when you look at the violence that Hollywood's producing at the moment for our young kids, you know, my grandchild is 15 and he wants to get these most extraordinarily violent videos and games. What on earth do these grown adult men think they're doing to our children to encourage the culture of violence in America?
Really, I read somewhere that the average American adult kid spends something like 13 hours, you know, every week on playing these violent video games. It's so depressing. Daughter was a college student at Duke University, and I went to visit her, and there in the middle of the college green were these two large, military recruiting trailers, and one of them was devoted to all these fancy military video games to, you know, give you the idea of what, you know, this exciting combat experience might be. I was depressed.
Did you go in and confront them? I would have.
I was rushing off, and I didn't.
I don't know where their heads are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What they're doing is, you know, sort of making a seamless transition from, violent video games to, you know, real combat. And of course, some of the weapon systems that they are creating are basically designed to, you know, insulate, people pulling triggers from the results of you know, what they're doing.
Which ones, Miriam?
Well, just you know, all the way that aircraft, you know, since basically the Vietnam era has distanced, you know, the people dropping the bombs from what's going on down below.
Yes, but now that they have these drones that target, you know, wedding parties and, you know, thinking they're terrorists and the rest.
That insulates people even more. They're not above. They're maybe in some other country.
Well, they're in Florida or California mm-hmm. with a consul and, you know, they're military officers. But the thing is now, Miriam, that, you know, when you're a pilot, you drop bombs, you go home, you do a high five and that's it, with a shark painted on the front of your aeroplane. This time they actually see the body parts after the missiles have been fired from the drones, and these people are having to have psychotherapy. Isn't that...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's absolutely... I don't know. And then, you know, they glorify war, and then when the poor things come home, you know, they've got post-traumatic stress syndrome. They kill themselves. They kill their wives. They drink. They take drugs. They're homeless. Or they're in Walter Reed with no arms or no legs or, you know, brain injuries never to recover. It's amazing how the military can glorify war, isn't it?
It is. I don't really have anything to add to what you just said.
Well, I can.
Pretty much summed it up.
And as a physician, you know, you have to wonder what it is in the reptilian midbrain and the males that sort of just loves this stuff. Anyway.
Yeah, you mentioned this book that I did a couple of years ago on the Iraq War, trying to sort of encapsulate some of the lessons. And
yeah.
I was fortunate to have a chapter written by Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize economist, and Linda Bilmes of Harvard, who had recently published a book, The $3 Trillion War. And so they kind of took that research and kind of encapsulated it in you know, the lessons of how the war costs have been hidden. And a large portion of the book and of those costs they attribute to the future costs that we're going to be paying for years for, you know, the traumatic brain injuries that's been caused in Iraq.
Yeah, so it's a projection or a prognosis of what the war will eventually cost in the long run, let
right.
alone, you know, over a million civilians being killed in Iraq already. It's really genocide. Anyway, Miriam Pemberton, I'm interviewing Miriam Pemberton, who's a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Miriam, tell us basically what the lessons from Iraq are.
You know, well, what we tried to do was say, you know, in a sort of a desperate attempt to come up with some possible, you know, something good that might come out of this disaster. And what we came up with was, you know, if we could sort of agree on a set of lessons that this war has taught us so that we never have to do those again, then we would have some sort of positive outcome.
So what are the...
So,
what, yeah.
Yeah, so you know, we came up with a list of about 16, and then we found experts to write up, you know, what is the lesson here, and how can it never be repeated? So, you know, can't go through them all, but for one example is the preventive war doctrine, which was the Bush administration's doctrine that you didn't have to wait for a conflict. You could go after some area where you thought conflict might start so that you would prevent it from starting, which is, of course, a license to go anywhere and do pretty much anything. So the question is what the Obama administration has, you know, has it continued this doctrine or has it gotten rid of it? And the answer is, you know, officially it's gotten rid of it. Its national security strategy has removed the preventive war doctrine. It's no longer part of our official strategy, but, you know, you mentioned these drone attacks. that we're doing in Pakistan, you know, I think there could be an argument that those are preventive, although I think what the administration would say is that, you know, Al-Qaeda attacked us, that Al-Qaeda is now in Pakistan, so we're going after Al-Qaeda. But I think it's an arguable point. But officially, the preventive war doctrine has been a lesson that this administration has at least learned in official terms. Another part of the book looks at, you know, what were the real reasons we went to war, and I assume you and your listeners have talked and heard a lot about wars for oil, and the way to learn that lesson would be, you know, what we call energy independence, or, you know, an energy transition, and I think that President Obama wants that energy transition, but he really hasn't spent the kind of political capital that would have been needed to overcome all this resistance to a serious climate bill, and so we don't have one, and so we are nowhere close to an energy transition, and so we're vulnerable to events going on now that are boosting our oil prices, from events in the Middle East.
What's another lesson?
Torture. So my husband actually is defending several of the Guantanamo detainees, and he says, you know, he's been to Guantanamo several times, and he's pretty convinced. He thinks we can be sure that there is not torture going on there now. But otherwise, he says the policy is simply no better, that they're using the same kinds of flimsy evidence that was used, some of it gathered under torture, and as we just saw, they've now, you know, sort of abandoned the idea of closing Guantanamo, and they're going to be holding military trials there, which they said
but
they weren't going to do.
Can you tell us why you think that is, Miriam? When Obama announced when he was first elected that he would close Guantanamo, he would not hold military trials, which are unfair. He would hold civilian trials. Why has he gone back on his word? What are the forces opposing what he said?
You know, I think, I don't know the answer to that. I think he is picking his spots. I think he, you know, has set a few priorities and is putting all of his energy into those priorities. And as we know, Democrats are, you know, terrified of being perceived to be, you know, weak on national security. And so I think they just got scared and decided, you know, we're just going to let this one go. But given that he was so clear, you know, from... It was almost his first public statement, upon taking office.
Yeah,
it's both troubling and sort of mystifying about why he felt he could do that.
I keep thinking of true leaders, and he seemed to be a true leader. But FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was a true leader. He hated the capitalists, and they hated him with a passion. But he got the country back on tracks with his, what was it called, the huge program where he built bridges?
New Deal.
The railway tracks and the whole thing, and re-employed millions of people. And they loved him. I'll never forget his white train going through the country after he died, because PBS did a documentary on this. And the look on the people's faces of such grief and such love. Because they knew he was representing them. Mind you, he came from the wealthy classes. He came from so-called aristocracy. So he had the measure of these capitalists and what they were up to. Whereas Obama was a community worker and a conciliator, a very fine man, I'm sure. But to be a true leader, you can't be afraid.
Yeah. Friend of ours served with him on the Harvard Law Review and said, you know, when Obama was the president of the Harvard Law Review, and said that, you know, even back then, and he, you know, our friend said this before he took office. He said, you know, his style is, you know, he figures out the sort of range of views in the room and puts himself right in the middle.
Yeah, which is a good quality, but in the present day and age when the Earth is threatened, of course, with global warming, and it's really upon us now, it's really very acute, and the ever-present threat of nuclear war and the like, we need someone to say, look, to hell with this conciliation technique. Now I'm going to be a true leader. And the people would follow. That's the sad thing. I'm interviewing Miriam Pemberton, a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. What are there any other lessons? Well, sure, you had 16 lessons in your book on Iraq. You've noted three. Are there any more prominent ones that stand out, Miriam?
Well, I think the question of imperial overreach. I think the Bush administration, you know, said it was going to war because of the imminent threat of weapons of mass destruction, which we now know didn't exist. But what we also know is that they were committed to this, you know, immediately, seeing it as a pretext for, you know, establishing U.S. hegemony in the Middle East, so you know what we still have from that legacy is, you know, a global the U.S. has a global network of more than 700 military bases. Most of them are not large. Most of them are very small. But it is basically you know, undergirding the principle that the U.S. needs to be the global policeman. It needs to have a global military presence and, you know, to enforce our, you know, our strategic goals. And, I mean, I think that what we've seen with the Obama administration's, you know, kind of muddled but cautious response to, you know, current events in the Middle East, that, you know, being still mired in these two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, may have, so to speak, made them a bit gun-shy, may have made them reluctant to intervene militarily in another country in the Middle East. And yet, you know, they haven't taken any serious steps to pull back on our global network of military bases. They've declined, for example, to close the base in Okinawa, despite the fact that the Okinawan people have, you know, are vastly in support of the U.S. Getting out of Okinawa. They're simply going to move it to another part of Okinawa. So, you know, in terms of the imperial reach of our global network of military bases, the Obama administration has taken no steps to you know, reduce that global presence.
Yeah, I think what's happened is that the Pentagon is so powerful, those generals are so powerful, and the military-industrial complex, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, that, you know, to battle those people, I'm sure he could if he really stepped out, but they're an enormous presence, and they use nasty techniques, I think, to get their own way all the time. And we all thought when we elected Obama that he would do the right thing in this direction. But, I understand he's up against tremendous forces against him.
Yeah. I mean, so, as you know, the major weapon systems are protected by, I mean, they've been very strategic and very smart about the way they've spread them in key congressional districts and really in every state. It's basically a very clever political protection racket. and it works. And I think, though, that there's an, you know, there's kind of an interesting split going on in the Republican Party. You know, the Republican establishment is fully entrenched in the military-industrial complex and beholden to it. But, you know, these insurgent Tea Partiers, a lot of them are, you know, talking about the need for, you know, serious military cuts. Now, the defense industry is reaching out, so to speak, to these members.
I bet they are. Yeah.
There's a restaurant that's quite near my office, and it was reported in the paper a few weeks ago that 13 new freshman Republican members of Congress hosted all of the major defense contractors at a dinner, and the price of attending this dinner was, you know, a minimum of $5,000 to be, you know, contributed to the campaigns of these members. And so the military-industrial complex is seeking to, you know, influence these members, and some of them seem quite receptive.
So the members set up the dinner, or the military-industrial complex set up the dinner?
My understanding, as it was reported, is that the members were hosting this dinner. I mean, it's quite possible that it was the contractor's idea in the first place, but the members were the host.
Corrupt, isn't it? It's so corrupt.
It is. It is.
Well,
yeah.
then the next question, Miriam, is the uprising in Wisconsin and starting all over the country now with the unions and the ordinary people backing them. They don't tend to talk about the military budget, and it's sticking out like organ stops. That's the thing that has to be attacked, so to speak, and I really mean attacked. I mean, that money is the people's money, it's the taxpayers' money, and it's going into killing and maybe annihilation of the planet. When do you think people are going to wake up, Miriam?
Well, I found a bit of good news in a poll that was released. It was a Reuters poll, so, you know, very nonpartisan, that was released today, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it found that a majority, 51% of Americans, support reducing defense spending, as opposed to about 20% that want to reduce Medicare, Medicaid, and an even smaller percent that wants to reduce Social Security. So that seemed like good news. Those are the two programs that, you know, all this deficit reduction mania is mostly leaving untouched. But I found some comfort in these poll numbers.
But what
seems
how
like
could
maybe
that,
people are waking it up.
Yeah, well then that needs to be translated into action, doesn't it, Miriam?
It does. And on that score, I'd like to mention that a colleague of mine at IPS and the
Institute for Policy Studies and...
Thank you.
And
the International Peace Bureau, which is based in Geneva, are teaming up to organize a global day of action on military spending. And they're timing this for the day after the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, which is the research body that produces an analysis of global military spending every year, and they are going to be releasing their report on April the 11th. And so these global actions are going to take place on the day after, on April 12th. And so if your listeners go to a website, demilitarize.org, they can look at all a map of where all of these actions are taking place. They can also organize one of their own. Currently, there are actions that are planned in 35 countries, including your home country of Australia. There's an event taking place in Adelaide, in Brisbane, in Canberra, and in Sydney. and elsewhere around the world. So it seems like a great moment to there will be stories printed about the SIPRI, the Stockholm report, and then these actions will take place to respond to those horrific numbers. I can't tell you what the global number is going to be because they're keeping it under wraps until April the 11th. But as you can imagine, the number is not smaller than last year, and you can also guess who remains the largest by far military spender.
You're listening to If You Love This Planet, and my guest today is Miriam Pemberton, a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Okay, now, what I'd like to just say, Miriam, is that the Department of Defense used to be called, appropriately, the Department of War, and they changed it, I think, soon after the Second World War. It really should be renamed. That's a euphemism to call it the Department of Defense, when America has enough weapons to produce nuclear winter and the end of life on Earth, and they're all, and you know, many are on hair trigger alert enough to produce nuclear winter. It's a misnomer to say defense, because then everyone says, oh, we've got to protect America and all that stuff. Do you want to comment?
So for several years, since 2004, I have headed up a task force that produces something called the Unified Security Budget.
Yes.
And the idea is to look at what the U.S. spends on security as a whole. So we call military spending offense, and then we call spending on this new homeland security, we call that defense, and then we call all of our non-military means of engaging with the world, so, you know, diplomacy, foreign aid, non-proliferation, peacekeeping, all of that we put under the heading of prevention. And so what this report does is compare what we spend on offense, defense, and prevention.
So give us the numbers.
Well,
or about, you know.
Yeah. Basically, we're spending seven times as much on our military means of achieving national security for every seven times as much as we are spending on both, you know, what we call defense, that is non-military homeland security, and all of the preventive measures, all of the ways we engage with the world by non-military means. So defense and prevention put together seven times as much on the military as on all of the non-military means of securing ourselves. And, of course, the argument we make every year is that this imbalance is not good for our security, that, in fact, we will be more secure if we rebalance our security resources and put more money into prevention, into diplomacy, and into, you know, real defense as opposed to military offense. And actually, the major national security leaders, including Secretary of State Clinton, including Secretary of Defense Gates, and including the Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, have all said in the last year that this imbalance is not good for our security. They basically agree with us, and they say that more money should be put into non-military ways of engaging with the world. But then their budgets come out, and it doesn't really happen.
So who designs the budgets? The, Lockheed Martin?
They certainly have a lot of input.
Yeah.
But Secretary Gates has, you know, it's reported that he is making cuts in the military budget, but it's not actually true. What he wants to do is, trim here and there, trim this system over here and then reinvest it in other military technology. He's sort of playing a more sophisticated, slightly more sophisticated version of the game that they play every year, which is they talk about cuts, but really what they mean is we're going to spend a little more slowly. We're going to increase at a little more slow rate, and so then we're going to call that a cut in military spending, which it isn't.
Well, you say the proposed figure, $553 billion, to be spent by 2012 is 5% higher than was budgeted for 2011, higher in real terms than any budget of the Bush administration or any budget since World War II. So they're winning, they're going up and stealing everyone's money.
Right, right. Yeah. So they put out a plan that says, we're going to really jack up spending, in the next 10 years. And then their budget reduces that, inflated plan a little bit, and they call that a cut.
They're liars.
And the media continues to report it. Gates' military cut.
Where the hell is the media's head at the moment, Miriam Pemberton? Even the New York Times, sometimes it'll come out and say, yeah, this is not really a cut, and some op-ed pieces in the Washington Post do, but on the whole, they tend to be good American boys, salute the flag, hand on the heart, and go along with the Pentagon. Do you think?
I think the Times does the best job, and you're right that they have gotten the message that these aren't real cuts. I think they do the best job, they could go a lot.
Well, the other point you make too is the budget for international affairs. Would you like to describe that and where most of the funding goes?
So when we put together our unified security budget, we do a little rejiggering of the categories because the category for international affairs in the budget is you think of it as the State Department and its operations. And in fact, the second largest part of that budget is indeed administered by the State Department, but it's military aid.
It's not aid.
In Egypt and Pakistan, so we sort of take that money and put it onto the military side of the ledger, and then we take a couple of programs that are in the military budget, what I'm sure you know about, the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, that's about securing and dismantling stockpiles of nuclear weapons around the world, and in particular in U.S. and the former Soviet Union. So we think that is properly non-military spending, and so we put that on the non-military side of the budget. But it's really very... the international affairs budget is very distorted by the fact that a large portion of it is actually military.
Well, it's just a gift to the American corporations. That leads me to Egypt. Now, I've read for a long time that America gives $3 billion in aid, mostly military equipment, to Israel, and $3 billion also to Egypt. Yet the latest reports say that it's $1.3 billion to Egypt per year. Am I wrong?
The figure is about $1.3 billion a year.
Okay, well, so it's interesting. I just had some American friends staying with me. They've just left. And as one of them, who's very astute, pointed out that if they do the no-fly zone, Americans will be bombing the very weapons that they gave to Libya and Colonel Gaddafi.
Mostly Libya has been supplied, it's my understanding, by European countries.
Oh, that's right. America doesn't.
The US.
Yeah, America doesn't like Gaddafi. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's right. So to punish Gaddafi, they don't sell him weapons. Other people do. So it's free for all.
But you look at Iraq, and yeah, there we were bombing people who were armed by
America
back in the 80s. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you talked about Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. Of course, that was Al-Qaeda was created by America, which funded and armed it during the war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan.
Yeah,
and
the
Taliban.
Ironies abound.
The ironies abound. I mean, God almighty. Why? John Stewart should do a show on that or Colbert.
Yeah, I'm nudging Bill Hartung to get on that show.
Oh, Bill should be on it. Yeah, he's very funny.
Yeah.
He's your colleague, of course, and has been fantastic in assessing the military budget from way, 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 way back. So I see the only way that America can possibly regain its economic health is by taking, what about taking $500 billion from the military budget? All these blasted planes they're building and new ships and new Trident submarines or refitting and $85 billion going to build new nuclear weapons all around the country. And that was the price Obama had to pay to get that awful guy, Senator Kyle, to go along to sign and ratify the New START treaty. So in order to try and lower the level of nuclear weapons between Russia and America and to build up faith and trust again with Russia, Obama with Medvedev and Putin negotiated the New START treaty. But in order to get the Senate to ratify it, he had to spend another $85 billion on building new nuclear weapons.
Right. And then, as I recalled, you tell me, because I'm sure you followed it more closely, Senator Kyle didn't vote for it in the end.
Didn't
he?
Right? Oh, that's right.
I don't think he didn't.
$85
billion for
I can
nothing.
Think of a very rude word for Senator Kyle, an Australian word, which you would probably be offended by, so I won't use it.
But the good news is he's not going to run again. So.
Yeah, I know. But look, what an uphill battle Obama has now with this new Congress. My God, they're cutting every single thing that's good for the health of the planet, good for the health of the American people, good for the health of the people around the world. I mean, it's such ignorance. Yeah. That's what takes my breath away. They don't have the scientific background, literacy or knowledge to know what earth they're up to.
Yeah, I mean, my hope certainly is that they are overreaching and the voters will come to their senses, you know, and realize that they made a big mistake.
But that's not for 2 years. And the other thing is that are they going to end supply? I mean, are they going to vote for a new budget? I think they run out of money in a week or two, don't they, Miriam Pemberton?
Yep. They are probably going to do another, you know, what they call a continuing resolution, just a little stopgap measure so they can keep fighting. I mean, I don't think this draconian Republican House budget is actually going to make it. I don't think it has any chance of making it because, you know, the Senate
will veto it.
Well, the president would veto it, but the Senate won't, you know, let it get that far. But still, the compromises that they are going to have to get to make to, you know, finally pass a budget for, you know, the year, the fiscal year that we're currently in already, are not going to be good.
Yes.
So one possible way of going after the military budget that Bill and I and others have been working on is something called the Sustainable Defense Task Force, that Congressman Barney Frank put together. This Sustainable Defense Task Force was empowered by him to come up with a proposal for what could be cut with no loss of security from our military budget. And so we came up with a proposal for $100 billion, and the Deficit Reduction Commission basically adopt, at least it adopted our figure that $100 billion could be cut out of the defense budget with no, no damage to our national security. It's sort of a dangerous game to play because we want to make sure that, you know, if they're going to cut the deficit, that the largest portion of the discretionary budget, that is the military budget, gets, you know, cut proportionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the price of that would be, you know, these draconian cuts in the domestic budget, which we need. One of the commissioners on the President's Deficit Commission, Andy Stern, who was formerly the president of the Service Employees Union, he had an alternative proposal that did cut about $1 billion, and it really adopted our proposal, you know, completely. But he said we have two deficits. One is the budget deficit, indeed we do, but we also have an investment deficit, so that we need to make investments in the civilian side of the economy to grow the civilian side, so that we can create jobs and get out of our recession. And what's happening now is the Republican Congress is just obsessed with cutting this very small portion of the budget that is funding, you know, grants for poor students to go to college, for the Head Start programs, for early childhood education, the money to implement the Clean Air Act, you know, all sorts of investments in, you know, creating a transition to a clean energy economy, all of these things. That's what they're going after, and pretty much leaving the defense budget untouched.
The war budget.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when I wrote my book Missile Envy in 1984, I was just amazed to find how much money they spend on military bands. The Navy, the Air Force, and the Army and the Marines, they all have their own bands, and lots of them. So lots of money is spent on that. They spend a hell of a lot of money on portraits to be painted of the military generals, and or fancy dinner parties and all sorts of things that are totally extraneous to anything military. And they just, they live on, in a land of plenty, milk and honey.
They actually spend more on military bands than they do on our entire diplomatic corps.
Is that
and
true?
And actually there are more, yes, and there are more people employed by the Pentagon to do PR for the Pentagon than there are diplomats.
That is obscene. I could use again a nasty Australian word. That's obscene. Now, why don't you get John Stewart? I mean, that's perfect for John Stewart or Colbert, or you know, that should be headlines in the New York Times. They spend more on military bands than on the whole diplomatic corps.
I believe Nicholas Kristof, the Times columnist.
Yeah.
I believe he did cite that that little factoid.
No, but
so
not
it's
every
been in the Times.
But it's not a
and
factoid.
I think John Stewart also mentioned it at some point.
Yeah, but mentioning it isn't. You know how Beck goes after one thing, like the Tides Foundation, and he hammers it and hammers it, and he has drawings and blackboards and stuff. I mean, that could make, just imagine the show you could do with the military bands and the portraits and all of the extraneous things that they do, which they, you know, they're sort of floating on the American taxpayers, and they have themselves a very nice life, thank you. Then when they retire, quite early, they get a very good
job in the defense industry.
Well, first of all, they get a very good retirement fund, and then they go through the revolving door and work for, it's not the defense industry, it's the war industry. It's the killing industry, because what are these weapons for? They're to kill people. And that's why I want to know what it is that motivates these people to kill. I mean, I've spent my life trying to save lives. Talk about what do the anti-abortionists say? They're for life. Well, I'm for life, And yet these are death merchants, and I know that term's used, but it sort of rolls off the tongue. But you know, I put in my book The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military Industrial Complex, which I wrote just before he invaded Iraq. And then I got a piece from, I think, the Australian newspaper. And I gave a talk in a church, and I wept. I said, you know, I held up a picture of Iraqi children and a baby, and I said, is this baby or child any different from an American child? And then I read a piece in the paper where an Iraqi man was holding out pieces of his new baby and had been hit by a cluster bomb. I mean, I think to get down to the bottom line, Miriam, yeah, Americans respond to talk about money, yeah, but the bottom line is their lives and their love for their children and themselves, and what's life all about? What's a human being all about? And unless we translocate the money stuff into human terms, I think it's too easy to practice psychic numbing and marginalize the data. What do you think?
Well, I guess, you know, looking for a little rays of hope, I would just, again, you know, I got a bit of a lift by reading that poll, thinking that Americans, you know, are getting it, and they can distinguish between, you know, programs that are for people and that are the safety net and these, you know, military systems that we don't need. So, you know, we have to do something about the jobs. And I guess a couple of things that I'm trying to do to you know, push back against this argument that we need this, all of this military spending because it supports jobs. You know, one thing, we commissioned a study by the University of Massachusetts that looked at $1 billion spent on the military versus that same amount of money spent on renewable energy, and the major finding of that study was that that $1 billion would buy you about 11,000 jobs if you invested it in the military, and it would buy about 17,000 jobs if you put it into clean energy. Mm-hmm. And those are well-paying jobs on the clean energy side as on the defense side. But you know, you get more jobs for the buck by investing in things that
to save the planet
actually needs.
Yeah. The WTO, World Trade Organization, you know, that was set up by multinationals, mostly from America, but around the world, to, you know, for a level playing field. I love that term. And so what's happened is that they've been able to transfer almost all the manufacturing jobs out of America, and that's where America excelled, to the Philippines and to China and to India and the like, so that the poor old Americans are left with no really sustainable jobs and work, just sort of, you know, service jobs and servicing the economy and the like. So it seems to me that we need, once again, a real leader to say, look, the Earth's dying. We're in the intensive care unit and we're critically ill with global warming, let alone the threat of global nuclear war. So we are going to fix it, and we are going to put solar panels on every house in America, on every parking lot. We're going to make electrical cars that run on solar electricity. We're going to have solar farms in the desert, molten with molten salt, or however you store the heat. We're going to have wind farms all over the country, and if the people don't like the noise, it's too bad. We're going to close down all the nuclear reactors. Just imagine, and tidal power, and imagine how many millions and millions of jobs could be created. Then you export that technology to an energy-hungry world, and at the moment, China's exceeding you. But you know, it's sort of all there sticking out like organ stumps again, isn't it? Do you write about that?
Yeah, so I do an annual report comparing what the U.S. spends on military security as opposed to climate security. So we do a climate change budget. It doesn't get publicized. It's really hard to find, but we do find it every year. And so so we do that comparison. And what we found in 2008 was that the U.S. was spending $94 on the military for every dollar it was spending on, preventing climate catastrophe. So then in 2009, we had the stimulus package, the Recovery Act, and there was about $80 billion put into technologies for a clean energy transition. And so high-speed rail and, clean energy and home weatherization, energy efficiency, and so on. Mm. And so that narrowed that gap drastically. So then it became a gap of about $9 on the military for every dollar spent on the climate. But since the Recovery Act was, a one-time thing, once we did the analysis again in 2010, we found that the Obama administration has, it's improved over the Bush administration. So it's about $41 spent on the military for every dollar spent on climate.
Where can people gain access to your annual reports on comparing the military to the climate change spending?
There's our website, which is IP as in Peter, S as in Sam, -dc.org. They're all there. And also, just Googling military versus climate security, and they're pretty easy to find that way, too.
Good. And I commissioned a study, too, a few years ago by Dr. Arjun Makajani called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free, which you can download from IEER.org. And that tells you all the technologies that are now available and ready to use and implement compared to the cost of nuclear, and there's just no comparison. So the prescription for survival is there. It's been fantastic, Miriam, discussing this with you. It's so timely, so pertinent.
I very much enjoyed it. Thank you.
Tell your colleague, Bill Hartung, that he's got to get on his comedian's cap and get on John Stewart. Has he been on Stewart before?
No. I mean, I told him that, and now I'll tell him that you told him.
Oh, tell him it's an order from the doctor.
Okay, got it.
Well, thanks, Miriam. That's lovely.
You.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My guest today was Miriam Pemberton, a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. If you want to see more of our fascinating interviews with fascinating people, go to our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org. If you want to support us, there is a place to donate money, and we'd be very grateful for that. We'll be with you next week with another very fascinating interview. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.